From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
Sheriff Baca pleads ignorance. Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. LA Sheriff Lee Baca and Undersheriff Paul Tanaka admitted in public last week they failed to uncover the abuse of prisoners by deputies in county jails. They told a commission that's heard months of accusations by former department officials and others they were not told what was going on by their underlings. One commissioner commented, they buried their head in the sand. What's likely to happen next? Also tonight, LA Metro extends late-night train service till 2 a.m. We'll hear from night riders about what it's like in the wee hours. Later on, Mitt Romney across the pond and beyond. First, here's the news. Roman, I'll be back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Mitt Romney today was virtually endorsed by Poland's former president, Lech Walesa. Later on, we'll hear about Romney's overseas trip, ending in Poland after touching down with mixed results in Britain and Israel. First, this story. LA Sheriff Lee Baca and Undersheriff Paul Tanaka answered tough questions last Friday about the abuse of inmates by deputies in the county jails. They testified before a commission appointed last year by the Board of Supervisors after it was revealed that a federal investigation was underway. Robert Fattarucci is covering the story for the Los Angeles Times. Robert, good as always to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on, Warren.
I take it from your report that the sheriff and the undersheriff admitted there was abuse and that they'd failed to uncover it.
Yeah. What they both testified to last week is at least what the sheriff had told us in the past, that he was insulated from bad news in the jails by his top aides, that they wanted to fix it themselves. But what they should have done is let him know, because, you know, when a problem comes to his attention, he's the sheriff and he's a fixer. What his critics have pointed out is that, you know, no matter how you slice it, he has had to do a whole lot of fixing, often when a problem hits the point of a crisis, and that the sheriff's department over the last few years has seen scandal after scandal. And beyond that, what our reporting has shown is that at least one of his top managers said he did warn Baca about rampant brutality and aggressive deputy cliques in his jails, and that Baca ignored him.
What about the undersheriff? Did he also say he was insulated, or was he one of the people who insulated Baca?
Well, you know, he did admit to some blame, saying that if he had, offered up 100% diligence, they probably wouldn't have been there today. Several of the current and former sheriff's managers who have testified before the commission have accused him of, you know, fostering a climate in which deputy misconduct wasn't cracked down on. He accepted some blame, but, you know, he also offered up a blistering defense, calling some of his critics, outright liars, saying he's an easy target for folks in the department who may have not gone as far as they would have liked in the department. At times, though, the commission seemed a little bit incredulous by how much he claimed he didn't recall. For example, at one point, what came up were some alarming internal audits conducted by sheriff's officials long before the jail scandal that basically referred to, brutality on inmates and shoddy investigations. A top commander had told us that he told the undersheriff about those audits and tried to give them to him. But what Tanaka said last week was that he didn't learn of them until 2012. Which, you know, seemed unlikely because they were on the front page of the L.A. Times in 2011.
Again, Robert Fattarucci is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Once again, the sheriff said he was not told about widespread abuse. He did admit, however, that he was to blame. Commissioner Richard Druyan, then, a former U.S. prosecutor himself, asked this question.
If you're to blame, how do we hold you accountable?
Don't lick me.
Sheriff Baca declined to appear on our program. Steve Whitmore is the spokesman for the Sheriff's Department. And Steve Whitmore, as always, good to have you with us.
That's my pleasure.
What about the charges that were made on Friday? And obviously the sheriff had an appropriate response. He's elected countywide. But does he believe that the problems that arose and that have been uncovered have now been fixed?
Yes. And it's important to remember that not only does the sheriff and the undersheriff and say that, but also other people that have testified, as in Captain Borman, who testified in front of the commission a couple of weeks ago, where he repeatedly says things like, I know that's been addressed, so that's something that I would recommend that's already done. I know that he is properly following up on everything. I know that's been taken care of. Those are just a few quotes that I'm pulling out of his actual testimony. So yes, these things have been addressed, but it's important also to go back to that one little soundbite that you played, Warren, and I know that you understand this. The sheriff wasn't being flippant at all. He is an elected official, and basically all he was saying is that ultimately, I am responsible to the people of Los Angeles County. They're the ones who every year since 1998, excuse me, not every year, but every 4 years since 1998 have sent him back to office with over 70% of the vote. And that's what he meant in that context was I am ultimately responsible to the voters of Los Angeles County, and I hold that responsibility to the highest regard.
Was Captain Borman, whom you mentioned, is he still a member of the department, or is he retired?
No, he's a member of the department. In fact, the sheriff promoted him to captain a while ago, and he's in charge of what the sheriff has implemented, known as education-based incarceration, where people are educated while they're serving their time. No, he's very much a member of the department. In fact, Captain Borman has said that he probably wouldn't have testified if he hadn't been encouraged by the sheriff to do so. The sheriff believes that nobody is above examination, that it is through the illumination that we all get better. So that's why when Captain Borman did testify, and he had some things to say that your distinguished panel will probably comment on, but the most important thing to remember is that near the end of his testimony, he kept saying things like this: I think that's been handled. There was a failure to follow established policy. I know that's been handled.
But wouldn't you expect him to say that as a member, current member of the department who's been promoted by the sheriff?
Not at all. I expect him to tell the truth, and he did. And not only him, but others as well. Now, there have been some statements that the undersheriff and the sheriff have called into question, but as the sheriff pointed out during his testimony, the sheriff does not want to go relive the past. He wants to start living. How do you fix it? How do you solve this problem? And that's why it's also important to remember that the total number of force incidents have decreased more than 27% compared to last year. Equally encouraging is the 52% reduction of significant force incidents during the same period. Things are being done.
Is that because of the federal investigation that was revealed last year?
Oh, I think that you have to give, the cause and effect, absolutely.
And is it, does that mean that things won't get worse in the future? Is there a mechanism in place to make sure that things don't slip back to where they were before?
No, there's a mechanism in place, and it is the command management task force that the sheriff has put together, five commanders, as well as other things have happened as well. And I think some of the credit has to be given to the undersheriff, who during the process, as soon as the sheriff created the commander management task force, the undersheriff behind the scenes worked hard to identify 21 supervisors from other department assignments to fulfill an existing need for more supervision at Men's Central Jail, just as an example. Things are being put into place that now will last, we hope, for time immemorial in the L.A. County Sheriff's Department.
Have people been disciplined for abuses in the past?
Yes. People have been fired.
Steve Whitmore, it's good to have you back on our program. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome, sir.
Okay. Mr. Whitmore indicated he did not want to interact with our other guests. Michael Giannacco is chief attorney for the Office of Independent Review. Michael Giannacco, good to have you back on our program.
Good afternoon, Warren. Good to be back.
Tell us what your organization is and what it's supposed to do.
Our office is intended to ensure that when there is an allegation of misconduct, that there is a thorough and unbiased investigation, and that when it is found through the investigation that deputies have violated policy, that they be held properly accountable for those violations, including discipline up to and including termination.
Did you, along with the sheriff and the undersheriff, miss what was going on?
I think that we have been aware of some of the issues since we first got started, and those issues continue to impact the department in a negative way. What is good about the increased attention is that the more eyes that are put to bear on the situation, the greater likelihood that things are going to get done for the better.
What are the issues you're talking about, and why haven't you done more to prevent them?
Well, the issues range from inadequate investigations at the unit level all the way through increased and better policy. And while we have been, I think we have made great strides, you know, things can always get better, and things always do need to get better with regard to any organization.
As we've heard before, and as we heard a moment ago from Robert Federici of the Los Angeles Times, there has been accusations, particularly with regard to Undersheriff Tanaka, that he's encouraged an atmosphere where people would go into the gray area, as it was called, and that sounded to a lot of people like going right up against violating policy, even violating the law. Are those charges, do you think, reasonable?
I think that the imagery and the confusion that was apparently received as a result of those comments certainly could confuse deputies and properly guide them, and I am glad that he is I tried to clear that up. It's probably been a few years too late. When he was making comments like that, I actually had a personal conversation with him and suggested to him that he should that these comments were being misinterpreted, and he agreed to stop. I think the sheriff had that same conversation independent of me, and I do think that those conversations stop, but we may be still paying the price for that confusion that he had communicated to deputies.
Is your Office of Independent Review working with the commission appointed by the Board of Supervisors?
Yes, we are certainly providing insight into the 10 years that we've been monitoring the department, as well as ensuring that they have a good understanding of how the department works, and maybe as importantly, providing them the necessary documents they need to do their work.
Michael Giannacco, again, Chief Attorney for the Office of Independent Review in the Sheriff's Department. Peter Eliasberg is Legal Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California. Mr. Eliasberg, good to have you back at our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
What is your role, the role of the ACLU in all of this?
Well, for years we've been going into the jails and had good access to the jails and talking to inmates and observing what we've seen going on. And what we have done over the years, certainly for the past 5 years, is report over and over again that there was a problem with excessive force in the jails. And one of the things that I found disturbing about both Mr. Whitmore's comments and also Sheriff Baca's is that for years they just simply said it wasn't true, the inmates are lying, the ACLU exaggerates. Now, I think only because there is a federal government investigation and they can no longer cover up the extent of the problems, they're willing somewhat to cop to it. But, you know, it's you have to look at what they're saying today in that light. How do you have an organization that, when there was a lot of evidence of malfeasance and wrongdoing and abuse going on, that Sheriff Baca and Mr. Whitmore would continually go forward to the public and say, oh, it's just not true, the ACLU exaggerates, the inmates are lying. And then even today, Sheriff Baca basically said, or on Friday, we know we screwed up, but we don't really want to dig into the past. Stop digging up dirt. Let's just focus on the future. That, to my mind, is not somebody who's deeply committed to accountability. I mean, imagine, Warren, if you have a teacher talking to a student who's done wrong, and the student just says, well, let's not focus on the past. I just want to focus on the future. You can't really focus on getting it right in the future if you're really willing to talk extensively about what happened in the past and how it went wrong.
Well, we just heard, though, that Steve Whitmore, the sheriff's spokesman, said that people have been fired.
Well, individual deputies, but in terms of, he was very pointedly asked the question by Mr. Druyan, what have you done with respect to your top managers who you say kept all this bad information from you? And he said, I don't want to talk about that, and it's not your job to tell me how to deal with my internal, you know, management problems. So when he says, let the public, you know, the public can decide whether they want to really reelect, that may be correct, but he also owes the public an explanation about what he's done. He says his high-level managers kept from him this information. Well, if that's the case, what has he done about that? And he told Mr. Druyan, I'm not basically going to answer that question, not your business, let me handle it, trust me. That's not accountability.
Michael Giannacco, with the Office of Independent Review, you're not here to defend the sheriff, but well, how would you respond to that concern by Peter Eliasberg?
I think it's a legitimate concern. I think certainly It's not unique to the Sheriff's Department, but I've seen large organizations in which information doesn't adequately flow to the top. And people, particularly in the police culture, people try to fix it themselves when, in fact, the fix may not be there. And I do think that mechanisms need to be put into place so that that doesn't happen again. And hopefully the sheriff is understanding of that.
So, Peter Leisberg, what sorts of mechanisms would you want to see?
Well, I think, again, until there is the sheriff is willing to talk about how it is, what were the mechanisms that kept his command staff from providing this information to him. But I think more importantly, one of the ways you fix problems is people have to be held accountable. I mean, I'm a manager, and I don't have managers nearly as large an organization as Sheriff Baca, but if people below me don't report to me that there are major problems, that we're missing filing deadlines and cases, and that's not coming to me, and somebody should have been providing that information to me, I can guarantee you, Warren, that the person who withheld that information to me would be seriously disciplined for it. But if Sheriff Baca either isn't willing to discipline those people or isn't willing to let the public know what discipline he's taken, that's a huge vacuum in our ability to evaluate what steps he's taken.
Let me go back to Robert Fattorucci. If, in fact, the sheriff sort of stonewalled in this instance when asked what he had done and said the commission can't tell him how to run his department, what can the commission do? What's its authority?
Well, you know, Sheriff Baca, when this commission was first formed by the County Board of Supervisors, you know, he pledged to you know, listen to them, to take their recommendations seriously. But, you know, beyond applying public pressure, they have no, you know, defined authority. They can't make him do anything. And on Friday, I believe it was one of the commissioners asked him, you know, do you pledge to you know, act on all our recommendations? And what he said was, you know, until I see them, I'm not committing to anything.
Mr. Giannacco, with the Office of Independent Review, you said Mr. Leisberg's concerns were legitimate. Should the public give the sheriff the benefit of the doubt here, or should there be a demand, do you think, for greater public accountability and more action?
Well, I think that the sheriff should take very seriously any recommendations coming out of the commission. You know, it's interesting, now that the eyes have been placed on the department, I do see an increased willingness to accept recommendations from everyone, including our office. So to the degree that he's listening, hopefully we can take advantage of that and get some things done.
Well, do you know that'll continue after the pressure of this public inquiry goes away?
Well, you never know that, do you? And that may be the rub, but I'm going to take advantage, or I was going to take advantage of the time now to try and get things done and to put policies in place and protocols in place so that some of the issues that have plagued the department do not recur. But the bottom line is all the policies in the world don't make a heck of a difference if you don't have the right people in place to implement those policies.
Peter Leisberg, back to you. A final word from the ACLU. What about the federal investigation, and do you think that the government needs to take some sort of action?
I certainly think that there were a number of criminal violations committed by deputies in the jails. Obviously, I am a civil lawyer. I don't do criminal cases, but I think that there is a strong basis to believe that that happened, and I am certainly hopeful that there will be indictments that come down for the deputies who deserve those indictments. But again, it's, you know, the federal government keeps the scope of their criminal investigation and very close to the vest. We'll only know what's going to happen when indictments are announced, if any, but I certainly believe, based on some of the things I've seen, that there is room for criminal prosecutions.
Robert Fattorucci, any idea when the federal government might reach some sort of conclusion about what it's doing?
Well, we've seen one deputy charged and plead guilty with a crime. Now, he was the deputy who, you know, unbeknownst to him, he smuggled in a cell phone for, you know, an inmate informant from folks he didn't know were FBI agents. So, I mean, he sort of got ensnared directly in the investigation. It wasn't, you know, abuse-related. But, you know, from our reporting, we do know that they have thrown a lot of resources and a lot of time at this and have asked for a lot of records and data. The federal government and the FBI obviously moved slowly, but I would be you know, surprised if we didn't see more come from their investigation.
Mr. Giannakko, any relationship between you and the federal authorities, or do you have any insight into what they're up to?
I really don't, Warren, although, you know, the department is doing its best to comply with any requests for documents. I used to have that job, so I know how difficult it is to make these cases, and I'm sure that they're going to do an objective assessment and let the chips fall where they may.
Michael Giannakko with the Office of Independent Review, Robert Federici with the L.A. Times, Peter Eliasberg with the ACLU, and our earlier guest, Steve Whitmore, with the Sheriff's Department. Thank you all very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Warren.
We'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way L.A. from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla. Or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter, at WWLA.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way L.A. L.A. Metro has extended weekend service on the blue, gold, green, red, purple, and expo lines from midnight until 2 in the morning. The Orange Line busway across the San Fernando Valley is running until 2:40 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday mornings, so Red Line passengers can still pick it up in North Hollywood. KCRW producer Anna Scott found some people had planned their nights around the new Red Line schedule, but others found it a pleasant surprise.
I did not know at all. I thought I was going to stay stuck out here. I was just going to stay in the streets or ask for a ride. So I'm blessed that we're going to go home now.
I did hear that it's open till 2 on Friday and Saturday, which is awesome. And I was just talking about it with my boyfriend about how we can now like take the subway and go out and not have to worry about, you know, having a car and designated driver and whatever. And we can just be safe and just take the metro and come back. So it's cool.
I have to work and my shifts usually end around midnight. So I'm very happy about this. I'm a cater waiter. I don't know why it took them so long, but I'm psyched about this, and also that they're going to extend the line down to Santa Monica.
Oh, yeah, we're very excited about it because we would have a $30 or $40 cab ride from the restaurant back to our hotel room.
I haven't rode the train in quite a long time, so it was good to know that they were actually running this late, although I didn't get nearly as drunk as I planned to, but that's okay.
Steve Hyman writes the Metro blog The Source. He previously covered transportation for the Los Angeles Times. Steve, good to talk with you.
Great. Thanks for having me. And it's I like the last interviewee there. It's great when you're young and you're honest.
Well, she said she didn't get as drunk as she expected to. What about the cater waiter who said, why didn't they do this sooner?
It's a good question because, you know, we were pushed really by two groups of people to do this. You know, one, folks who wanted to go out, and two, and even more so, people who worked. I think it was really a matter of reaching critical mass where the agency thought that the demand would be there, the money had to be there, you know, the rail lines had to be there. And so in some cases, we actually had to build them. And I think, you know, we had to see that different parts of town were really ready to go. And I think one of the best things about this is that there are actually places people want to go to after 11 o'clock in Los Angeles on the weekends. North Hollywood, Hollywood, downtown, Culver City, Old Pasadena. These are all places that in the last few years have, you know, been revived to some extent, you know, sometimes with the help of transit, sometimes not. But transit is heavily part of the mix in all those parts of town.
We've been hearing from the bus riders union lately saying that they think that the rail lines are getting much more of the a much bigger percentage of the resources than is justified. What about the bus lines? Are they staying open late too?
Yeah, I mean, there was already over 24 bus lines that ran all night long, and that's still the case. So there's always been overnight bus service. The rail service usually cut off between about 11:30 and 12:30, and then picked up again between 4 and 5 a.m. So what this really does is it just pushes the rail service to about 2 a.m. or so.
On the weekends. How much longer is it going to go on? Is this an experiment?
Yeah, they're going to try it for 6 months, see how the ridership is, and then reevaluate. But I expect it to be pretty well. We don't have numbers for this weekend in yet, but anecdotally, it looked pretty good.
What about security?
You know, so far, so good. You know, generally speaking, it's been a very safe system all along. It's safer than often the streets that are around it. There have been incidents, just as there have been incidents on transit in many other cities across the world. You know, I don't think transit will ever be immune to what's around it. But it's been pretty good, and there certainly are sheriff's deputies out there.
You're working for L.A. Metro, but formerly you were a transportation reporter. How far behind is Los Angeles now in terms of having a comprehensive transportation system, one like they have in New York that runs 24/7?
Yeah, I don't think very far behind at all. I think what this does is it puts L.A. very close to what you see in a few of the older East Coast cities where there is 24-hour service. The fact is there's very few transit agencies around the country that run all night long, certainly on the rail side. So Metro is very close right now. I mean, there's about a two-hour gap on the weekends with some of the rail lines closing in and then opening again. In terms of the mileage and the ridership, we're right up there. In the last fiscal year that ended this past July 1st, Metro Rail had 100 million riders, first time ever. And that makes it certainly the light rail part of it is one of the most heavily ridden light rail systems in the country. The subway's behind just because, you know, other places have a lot more subway than we do. But the subway that we have does very well.
Has the Expo line drastically increased ridership?
I wouldn't say drastically. I think the last numbers we have, which are for June, are that it was averaging about 16,000 boardings a day on weekdays, up from 11,000 in May. And that's even with the Culver City station opening rather late in the month. So it certainly seems to be trending in the right direction. And, I mean, from what we've seen, there's a lot of people on it, and already people have been using it for special events, such as when the Kings were in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Is the does the rail bring riders that don't want to ride the bus?
I think so. I mean, that's not a very popular thing to say, but, you know, I know amongst the people that I know, there are certainly some who are biased towards it and would much rather take the train than the bus. I mean, I think the advantage with the train over the bus is that the lines tend to be longer. You know exactly where the stations are. You know where the train is going. You know, a lot of people also take the bus. I mean, we still have, you know, well over a million boardings a day on weekdays for the bus. So it's not like the bus is an unpopular thing.
Well, Steve Hyman, it's always good to talk with you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. Again, writes the Metro blog, The Source, previously covered transportation for the L.A. Times. Our producer, Anna Scott, took pictures on that early morning Red Line train ride. You can see them at kcrw.com/whichwayLAblog. In a moment, Mitt Romney, across the pond and beyond on Which Way L.A. Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. Mitt Romney has arrived in Gdansk, Poland, where he was greeted by former president and Nobel Prize winner Lech Walesa. One member of the crowd at Old Town Hall held a sign in English saying, "Polish choice, Ron Paul." And Romney said it reminded her of a local rally in the United States. Walesa himself said this, "I wish you to be successful because this success is needed to the United States, of course, but to Europe and the rest of the world, too. Governor Romney, get your success. Be successful." That's Lech Walesa talking to a translator. Jonathan Broder is Defense and Foreign Policy Senior Editor for Congressional Quarterly. He's based in Washington. Jonathan, always good to have you on our program.
Nice to talk to you.
Is Lech Walesa going to make a difference in the presidential campaign?
Oh, I don't know. These visits are really aimed at a domestic audience, and the audience in particular in Poland that Romney wants to reach by going to Poland is the Reagan Democrats that are concentrated quite heavily in the Rust Belt and in Pennsylvania, which are swing states, Ohio. This is where he needs to build up support, and he's hoping that with the trip to Poland, he's essentially visiting the ancestors of the people that he wants to vote for him.
Isn't he also, to some extent, challenging the so-called reset that President Obama announced with regard to Russia?
Yes, he is. What he's doing is he's criticizing Obama for the reset, and he's described Russia as the number one geopolitical threat to the United States. The problem with this kind of talk, of course, is that if Romney were to win the election in 2014, U.S. troops are scheduled to come out of Afghanistan. That's a date that Obama set, but that Romney agrees with. And in order to facilitate the withdrawal of those troops, the United States is going to have to maintain good relations with Russia because a lot of that stuff is going to be flying out over Russia and using their airspace. So that kind of talk is easy during a campaign, as it often is. You see presidential candidates sounding tough during a campaign, but then their behavior, if they were to become president, is a lot different.
Have we heard from Romney any really significant issues that are different from, or positions, I should say, on foreign policy that are different from those of President Obama?
That's a good question. I mean, essentially what Romney is doing is he's criticizing Obama's foreign policy, saying that he's been weak, apologetic, and naive toward America's adversaries and rivals like Iran, China, and Russia, and that toward friends like Israel, Britain, and Poland, his stops on this trip, he's been cool, distant, and unreliable. But when you look past Romney's rhetoric and you focus on the few details that he's offered about his foreign policy, there really isn't that much difference between Romney's prescription so far and what Obama has done. So, for example, on Iran, Romney says he'd demand that Iran halt all nuclear enrichment activities, including 3.5% enrichment. That's a low-enriched uranium that you would use for a nuclear power plant, but not for a bomb. And he says he will use all available means, including the military, to make sure Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon. Now, his demand on Iran's halting all nuclear enrichment does go further than Obama, but the threat of possible military action, which is the real issue here, amounts to the same thing that Obama's policy has called for, which says that all options, including the military, are on the table.
Let's hear a bit of what he had to say with regard to Iran. Here's a bit of his speech last night in Jerusalem to donors and supporters.
We must not delude ourselves into thinking that containment is an option. We must lead the effort to prevent Iran from building and possessing nuclear weapons capability. We should employ any and all measures to dissuade the Iranian regime from its nuclear course. No option should be excluded. We recognize Israel's right to defend itself and that it is right for America to stand with you.
Shmuel Rosner is editor, researcher, and writer based in Tel Aviv. He blogs at Rosner's Domain, and he's senior political editor for the Jewish Journal. He's also a former U.S. chief correspondent for Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, and he's author of Shuttle, Bagel, and Baseball on the Dreadful, Wonderful State of America's Jews. Good to have you on our program.
Good evening from Tel Aviv.
Did we hear anything different in that statement, that speech, by Mitt Romney, with regard to Iran? Anything significantly different from what we've heard from President Obama?
No, in fact, I agree with your previous interviewee. Candidate Romney offered Israelis many platitudes and many good, feel-good generalities regarding his a probable policy if he becomes president. But as for specifics, all the details he mentioned were very similar, if not identical, to the statements previously made by President Obama. The only difference, I would say, is evident between Romney and President Obama is that Israelis tend to believe Romney's words more than they tend to believe Obama's. But other than that, on specifics, in almost all issues, they were practically identical.
Why do they believe Romney more than Obama?
Well, they have 4 years of experience with President Obama, and Israelis tend to think that President Obama was not the friendliest of all presidents. He tend to go into public battles with the Israeli government over settlements, over the peace process. He started his term pretty determined to push the Israeli government around and make it make concessions. This didn't come out very well for President Obama, but Israelis got the impression that this current president doesn't have the best of intentions when it comes to having a policy that is identical to the policies of the Israeli government.
Do you think that he's in Israel in order to try to persuade Jewish voters to vote for him? Is there a possibility that they could actually make a difference in this campaign?
No, I think that's one of the great myths that the press is trying to perpetuate, but I don't think Jewish voters will matter much in this coming election. I don't think Jewish voters have the ability to tip the coming elections or any elections towards one camp or the other. And besides, it is pretty clear by now that almost all Jews, 70% or so of Jewish voters are going to vote for Barack Obama. His percentage in 2008 was 78% according to the exit polls, but it was really closer to 74% according to more recent research. So he will probably will not get 74% again. He'll probably go a bit down, maybe to 70%. But these 4% of Jews shifting from Obama to candidate Romney will not tip this election.
Shmuel Rosner again in Tel Aviv. Rosner's Domain, the Jewish Journal, also columnist for the international edition of the New York Times. Ron Campeas is Washington Bureau Chief for JTA. That's an international wire service covering issues of relevance to the Jewish community. Thank you very much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think that there is a significant effort on the part of candidate Romney to appeal to Jewish voters, or is he really looking for people like Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino magnate, who was there attending the speech last night in Jerusalem?
I think primarily the, first of all, not to discount that Romney actually, believes what he's saying. This does come from a worldview that is now prevalent in the Republican Party, the insistence on no daylight with Israel. Not to discount that, but yes, the effort here is to appeal to a small elite of conservative Jewish donors to the Republicans. Not that they're not going to get their money anyway, but to try and impress upon them the differences with Obama in order to maximize the donations. There is a way that Jewish voting does play into that, and you see that in the emphasis that the Republican Jewish Coalition is now placing on actual Jewish voters that they've discovered that will ostensibly switch their votes from Obama in 08 to Romney in 2012. I think that donors like to think that they're influencing not just the political process, but they're influencing voters. But as Shmuel points out, as far as the polls go, that doesn't really play out on election day.
Here's something that Mitt Romney said in an interview with Wolf Blitzer of CNN with regard to the U.S. Embassy and whether it ought or ought not to be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
I think it's long been the policy of our country to ultimately have our embassy in the nation's capital of Jerusalem. The decision to actually make the move is one, if I were president, I would want to take in consultation with the leadership of the government, which exists at that time. So I would follow the same policy we have in the past. Our embassy would be in the capital, but that's the timing of that is something I'd want to work out with the government.
Let me go back to Jonathan Broder with Congressional Quarterly. Is this something that differentiates Mr. Romney from President Obama?
It's always been American policy to say basically that Israel claims its capital is Jerusalem, but the United States doesn't recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. It believes that that's a final status issue that has to be worked out in peace negotiations, and it doesn't recognize the Israeli annexation of East Jerusalem, which Israel conquered in 1967 war. By the way, most countries in the world also don't recognize it. It sounds to me like Romney is really not committing himself. He's sort of leaning toward moving the embassy, but he's not giving any sort of flat commitment to do so.
Shmuel Rosner, is that different from what we've heard from other presidents or other candidates for a president in the recent past?
Well, it is different than things we've heard from the other Republican candidates in this 2012 race. When Romney was still running against other Republicans for the nomination of the Republican Party, he was pretty much the only candidate, maybe except for he was the only one from all candidates not to commit himself to a policy of moving the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I don't think that he did go half a step forward yesterday in his remarks. This is the only place in which he deferred a little bit from President Obama. He did specifically say that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, but he did not say that Israel cannot, that Jerusalem cannot also be the capital of a future Palestinian state, which is the which is what's going to happen according to the so-called Clinton parameters for the peace process, according to which Jerusalem can be the capital of both states. Romney did not preclude such such proposition, and he did not make any specific commitment for any specific date of moving the embassy to Jerusalem. So I think it was a symbolic statement, but again, not a practical change of policy.
Ron Kompias, back to you with JTA, the Jewish Community International Wire Service. Mr. Romney also spoke about the Palestinians and said that there was a comparison between the gross domestic product per capita between Israel and Palestine in the Palestinian Authority, the West Bank, of a very different, a very large amount. He was attacked by the Palestinians for a racist comment, and some Israelis suggested that he was making some kind of reference to the fact that Jews are good with money. Was that a blunder?
Yeah, I think it turned out to be a blunder. I'm not sure it would have been. You know how a political narrative develops. Once an element of that narrative is in there, it's difficult to shake. So he goes on his foreign trip and he makes a genuine blunder in London, and then people are looking out for blunders in Jerusalem, and so this sort of gets upgraded to blunder as well. I think he was talking about the better word for that he might have used might have been polity, might have been political culture. He would have still been subject to criticism because the Palestinians say that their limitations have a lot to do with the occupation, but by using the word culture, he allows himself to be criticized as saying that there's something inimical something inherent in the Western Jewish culture in Israel that allows it to have a more thriving business culture than the Palestinians.
Thanks to Shmuel Rosner in Tel Aviv and Ron Kompias in this country. Jonathan Broder is Defense and Foreign Policy Senior Editor for Congressional Quarterly. He's been with us during our program as we're talking about Mitt Romney's trip overseas. With regard to the trip to Israel, isn't he also appealing very directly, not just to Jews, but also to evangelical Christians?
Absolutely. Their votes are actually much more numerous than American Jews. I think American Jews, constitute 1% of the entire American population, and evangelicals are like 50 million people spread around the country. So the other audience that Romney wants to reach by showing such strong support for Israel are the evangelicals.
Again, Jonathan Broder with Congressional Quarterly. Let me ask you, everybody was astounded at what Romney had to say with regard to security preparations for the Olympics when he was in London. But you found an interesting excerpt from his book, No Apology, which came out relatively recently about Britain. Let me ask you to read it.
Oh, actually, I don't have that in front of me,
okay.
It basically says that that England is a very, very small country, and it doesn't really produce many products that the world really wants to buy.
England is just a small island. Its roads and houses are small. With few exceptions, it doesn't make things that people in the rest of the world want to buy.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine that. The Brits were not aware of that much when he made his gaffe at the over the security preparations at the Olympics. But I can't imagine that they would be very pleased about that.
Adrian Woolridge Jonathan Broder. Adrian Woolridge is management editor and Schumpeter columnist for The Economist. He's also a former Washington bureau chief for that magazine. Adrian Woolridge, good to have you back on our program.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
How does that sound? England is a small island. Its roads and houses are small. It doesn't make things that people in the rest of the world want to buy. How did that go down when Brits found out about it?
Well, it
didn't actually go down particularly well, I'm afraid. No, this has been a disaster in Britain for Mitt Romney. He came here to sort of reaffirm the special relationship and to draw attention to Obama getting rid of the bust of Churchill and the rest of it. And he's gone down like a lead balloon, really not at all good. You know, we are allowed as British people to grumble and moan and criticize our Olympics. That's our prerogative. But when foreigners do it, we get very upset, and people got very upset when Romney did.
Well, he did back away.
But he said it. That is not... I think it was, you know, it was rude and it was silly. And his criticism about the passport officers who threatened to go on strike was actually completely badly timed, because they've actually not gone on strike. But it indicates a sort of lack of sense of political tone, which is, I think, you know, the real issue here. Does this man have the right qualifications, the right attitudes to be president of the United States? And, you know, to come to one of your closest allies, if not your closest ally, when it's just about to launch the Olympics, and basically to be insensitive and shoddily rude about the country is not the most sensible thing to do. I mean, it's a disaster, I think, for him.
Let's talk about a journalistic tone. Your magazine, The Economist, would never do this, your newspaper, rather, as you call it. But there were tabloids saying with headlines like Mitt the Twit and Nowhere Man. Is that common in Britain, that a head of state, would, particularly an American head of state, would get headlines like that?
Well, a head of state, I think, possibly not. A candidate for being head of state, they would. You know, we have a very rumbustious, very aggressive press. But it wasn't just the tabloid newspapers that were being rude about him. It was also, you know, his fellow Conservatives, you know, both the Prime Minister, I think, and Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson essentially said, who is this guy, Mitt Romney? And David Cameron said, well, you know, he put on the Olympics in the middle of nowhere. We're doing it in, you know, a big city. And what he didn't say, but what is obviously implied, is that, you know, London was a great world city when Salt Lake City was just a Salt Lake. And I think this divorce, almost divorce, between the Republican Party and the Conservative Party in Britain, given how close they were in the days of Thatcher and Reagan, is really quite interesting. These two parties now seem to belong to different planets.
Let me introduce Adrian Wilbridge once again. Is a management editor and Schumpeter columnist for The Economist newspaper. Christopher Preble is vice president for defense and foreign policy studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. And Mr. Preble, it's good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You, generally speaking, aren't critical of Republicans, but you've not had a particularly good impression, apparently, of Mr. Romney with regard to a foreign policy. And other Republicans, too, appear to be concerned because he isn't making the kinds of distinctions between his own policies and those of President Obama that you would like to see. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, I think there are two in particular that are rather obvious. One is the war in Afghanistan, which, of course, is now increasingly unpopular, which is all the more remarkable because this was actually the one war that was connected to the events of 9/11 and was supported by a very sizable majority of the American people. President Obama, of course, increased the number of troops there and now is, you know, promoting the fact that he is modestly drawing them down, ignoring that there will still be more troops in Afghanistan in January of 2013 than there were when he took office. And Mitt Romney, curiously, has put himself to the left or right, depending on how you look at it, side of public opinion. In other words, you know, President Obama's decision to add the troops to the war and extend the war is not particularly popular, but Mitt Romney's position, such as it is even more unpopular. It basically is criticism of a withdrawal, you know, and having it be based on conditions on the ground and following the advice of the commanders, et cetera. Most Americans have are really wanting to move beyond that. And I also think, beyond Afghanistan, I think it raises some serious questions about the lessons that Governor Romney and his senior foreign policy advisors have taken away from the war in Iraq. I mean, fairly or not, I think mainly fairly, the war has so badly damaged the Republican Party's brand on foreign policy that it would be wise for him to try to differentiate his position from that of John McCain in 2008 and from George W. Bush. On the contrary, he has populated his administration with not simply people who
not his administration, but his campaign.
His campaign with some of the strongest and most fervent advocates for the war in Iraq, and those who continue to argue that it was a good idea, where, again, most Americans who supported the Iraq War have changed their minds. And so on those two issues, just kind of the lessons he draws away from Iraq and how he would apply that to other missions in the future, I think really put him at odds with the majority public opinion on foreign policy.
Adrian Wooldridge, back to you. How does this appear in London, where you say people are relatively happy with President Obama? Does Mitt Romney look more hawkish? Is that less popular in Britain than the president's position?
The answer to both questions is yes, he does look more hawkish. That is less popular in Britain. And I think this particular latest iteration of going to Israel and talking about the cultural superiority of Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians will go down very badly. Obviously, that's only just happened. I'm speculating about how it will go down, but I'm pretty certain there will be a lot of worry about that. That's very much an appeal to American exceptionalism and not something that will go down at all well in Britain. It will go down even worse in the rest of Europe. And the impression that I get, this is not the impression of the British people in general, it's my impression, but it's that this is somebody who is concerned with still appealing to his own side, with locking down a conservative movement that's very skeptical about him and a Republican Party that isn't quite in line yet. So he's still campaigning essentially to get his own voters on his side rather than trying to broaden his appeal, which is not what one wants to be doing at this stage in the electoral cycle.
Well, that's all the time we have for this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Thanks very much to all of our guests. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Anna Scott, Evan George, and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Special thanks to Ray Guarna. You can visit the Which Way LA blog for even more stories about Southern California at kcrw.com/whichwayla blog. I'm Warren Altney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.